Hi, and welcome back to the My Little Eye podcast. Over the course of this series, we've been joined by Rob, ex-Met police officer, Dr. Chris James Carter, an assistant professor, best-selling crime author Angela Clark, and book blogger Emma Mitchell. And they're all here with me again today. Hi, everyone.
Hey.
Hello.
Hi.
So I've got a few questions that I want to put to you all as a group. The first ones are from me, and the last few are from our folks on Twitter. So just to kind of kick off, in My Little Eye, we encounter a group of normal, everyday people who are obsessed with true crime. Over the past couple of years, we, as a country, have become obsessed with true crime stories from podcasts like Serial, which turned us into amateur sleuths during our morning commute, to the Netflix series such as Mindhunter and Making a Murderer. Why do you think it is that people are naturally fascinated by these crime cases?
People are fascinated by crime because we love a good mystery. Like, we like to ask questions, you know, we like to have stories, we like to have stories that kind of lead us through our day. And I think that crime is often asking some of the bigger questions about our kind of lives. So whether that's sort of a state of the nation or a human condition kind of situation, it's something that we are kind of naturally drawn to. You know, why would somebody do something so terrible, yeah. You know? And that need for answers, that need for justice, especially when things are perhaps increasingly tense on a wider kind of scale, on a wider political scale, for example, to have things resolved. I think resolution is really important.
Cool. What do the rest of you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think from a it's psychological perspective, I think it's I think with the series you mentioned, it's that idea that the person next to us on the tube or the next door neighbour, or it's that the heinous, terrible things that people do who otherwise seem, who we pass by every day and who you would never often be able to tell that that's what's going on. And I think on some kind of level, we're fascinated with that, like, dark side. We talked a bit before about kind of dark psychology, and, you know, it's always a fascination for academics to figure out why people do the naughty things that they do. I think absolutely it's that mix between the just unbelievably terrible with the everyday mundane things that people do, and that kind of the undercurrent that kind of goes throughout society.
Is it Agatha Christie who said, I'm going to paraphrase terribly, who said every murderer has a best friend?
Yeah.
It's that, isn't it? It's exactly what you just said. It's that idea that there's that, you know, that it's just a normal person has done this.
Totally, yeah.
I think people find it accessible.
Just about to say that.
Liar.
You should have written it down, though.
Murders come across all parts of society, and people understand it could be them, it could be the nearest and dearest. And conversely, that people who pay the police officers, that could be you. It could be any one of us, because cops are just members of the public who've just taken a particular job.
Yeah.
So it's not some sort of fantasy that's unachievable. They're very real, ordinary people. And it's easy to put yourself in that person's position, like that detective, that male or female who's investigating it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say that the accessibility side of it, I think a long time ago, the crimes were never as out there. I think social media, the internet, the TV programmes that are there and available nowadays, people watch them because it's on telly to watch, but then you get hooked onto that, you know, everybody became an overnight lawyer with Making a Murderer, everybody solving the Serial podcasts. And it's just available now. It's so much more out there. I remember watching something where there was a crime in a newspaper. It's a period drama, and they were complaining about the fact that this crime had been reported in the newspaper. So it just wasn't done, was it? And it wasn't, so they weren't as available to be involved with back in the day, whereas now it's just everywhere. And it's so interesting. It's so interesting trying to figure out who's done it. And kind of, I think sometimes you can read a crime book, watch a movie, read an actual crime that's happened, and just think, oh, I could potentially have done that to somebody, and you're just kind of sort of living crime sort of through other people, aren't you, sometimes as well.
And I wonder if there's something in it, like, in ourselves that we want to get closure on some of this stuff. We want there to be an endpoint. We want to know what's happened. Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, you kind of get that with crime fiction. We kind of usually try to neatly, through the arc, kind of make that happen, let you know what's happened. But in some of these cold cases and sort of true crime stuff, some of them are still unresolved. And yeah. I wonder if the fascination is partly that, you know, when I'm watching it, I want to know what happened. I want to solve that. Mm-hmm. Kind of get closure.
Jack the Ripper-ish, isn't it? You know, everybody's still, somebody's desperate, people are desperate to prove who it was all these years later. Still trying, I think I was programming about it last year, about a scarf that had been found with somebody's blood on it that they were absolutely adamant that it belonged to him. So it just doesn't stop, does it? People just desperate to be the one to solve the case that nobody else has done.
Do you think it's glory? Do you think it's glory?
Definitely.
We all want to be the clever detective that walks into the room and solves it at the end. Obviously, Rob's already done that.
yeah, he is that detective.
No, I was just the gorilla with a gun at the end of it. So. There were plenty of very intelligent detectives, but
That's still the protagonist in a lot of books.
The reality is completely different. It's, you know, there's not some great epiphany that hits somebody and then I've solved the crime. Crime detection is a lot of boredom, a lot of legwork.
You mean it's not like Murder, She Wrote, where, like, 37 minutes through it, Angela Lansbury will see something, J.B. Fletcher will see something, somebody will open a book and she'll go, oh my God, I now know what
it is. It's just boring legwork. And it's about collecting information, cross-referencing information, intel gathering. We'll talk to a number of sort of social media and the vast amount of intelligence that brings in. Information, I should say, a lot of which is useless, but got to go for it. And then you're knowing that it's all done and dusted, people are going to look back at the investigation about what was missed, what could have been done better, without really appreciating the huge amount of work that the officers had to go through to get to that conclusion. Mm-hmm. So it can be quite sort of soul-destroying and quite difficult, really, because long nights, long days.
Did you watch Making Murderer?
No, I haven't watched it.
Because I was just wondering, because it would be really interesting, because I never thought of it that way. Because when I was watching it, I was kind of like, I think most people, kind of becoming increasingly enraged by, like, the decisions that the police were taking in that case, because it just seemed so obvious that they were, you know, looking at it, that it was, like, really corrupt. But... It would be so interesting to see it from that perspective, almost kind of taking a more kind of empathetic
view. But that series is very... There was a really strong narrative in that series, and it was deliberately manipulative in terms of the audience. It was edited and sculpted like a story. So it was like a real story. So you have the pace, you have the cliffhangers, you have the kind of the goodies and the baddies. And I think that actually life is not usually like that, especially with that series, a lot of stuff has come out afterwards that makes it look like there were obviously clear mistakes were made. Perhaps in the second case, it was the reality, what was put forward was actually what happened.
Yeah, and I guess whenever anything is kind of televised or recorded, there's always going to be a kind of slant, there's going to be an angle, isn't there, that it's come out. And well, I mean, Rob will be able to say this either way, but, you know, you can present evidence to this case or that case, kind of depending on what your preference is. You know, you can argue anything either way, so it gets trickier, I think, when you're dealing with real cases rather than fiction.
TV likes no loose ends.
Yeah.
You like to, if you tie off the edge, it ends, so there's a clear delineation between what happened and what didn't happen. Real life is full of greys, and it's very seldom black and white.
Yeah.
A lot of circumstantial evidence. Which way do you go in the investigation? It's not easy. I was quite glad I did what I did when I was in the place. My life was relatively simple compared to those of detectives and complex investigations.
I'd be a rubbish detective. All of that long, diligent, hard work and going through like lots of kind of like quite dull thing. I'd get bored of that. I'd be trying to like create like random character profiles of people.
You'll be like the maverick, yes, and like the maverick detective going on.
Who doesn't know what they're doing.
So, do you want me to ask the question again? Yeah. So we've talked a bit about Jack the Ripper that Emma mentioned, but are there any particular cold cases that you find particularly interesting?
There are two that come to mind. Two jobs that I worked on years ago. I can't remember the specifics because they're both technically live investigations. But one of them was a female in an isolated house who was found murdered, and the other one was an academic who was killed in a house. And it appears that one of them, the academic, was killed as possibly a mistaken identity, but both of them probably killed by contract killers. Wow. Very professional, very little evidence left. And every now and again you think about it, I wonder what was really behind it. Because nobody knows. We think one was a case of mistaken identity. We think we know, or the police know, who the intended victim was, who looked very much like the person who was killed.
Wow. God, that's terrifying. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So, sometimes you think, I wonder, did that person commit any more murders?
That is terrifying, because people are always saying, like, oh, Tom, or, you know, they'll come up to me and go, oh, sorry, I thought you were a mate, aren't you? Like, generic face syndrome, like, you know, people, anyway. Me personally, I was thinking about this before, and I was a huge Mannix fan, like, when I was growing up, Mannix Street Preachers, so I was always, like, obsessed with what happened with Richie Edwards. Like to, you know, because you're a teenager at the time as well, so, you know, you go into, like, excruciating levels of detail, which no person outside of the police force probably should ever really have gone into, but, I'm always, like, really fascinated by that, so if, in case people listening to this aren't kind of familiar with it, Richie Edwards was one of the guitarists in Mannix Street Preachers and went missing in 95, just before they were due to go on tour in the States. And he'd been quite well known for having kind of mental health issues, and actually one of the few kind of people to be speaking very openly about it at that kind of time in that kind of industry. And anyway, sort of went missing and is technically missing since, but I think has since been classed as, officially gone. But it's very strange, like the circumstances, because his car was found near the Severn Bridge, I think. He'd withdrawn money and they were due to go away, and there were various different clues, and it became almost like a kind of sleuthing kind of activity afterwards, and various conflicting reports, and no one's really sure what happened at all. And there's been various sightings of him as well in, I think, Morocco and, you know, Lanzarote and all sorts of, you know, random places. So yeah, I've always been like quite fascinated by that and what might have happened, but yeah, who knows.
Yeah, I think I was, certainly as a teenager, I was kind of fascinated by the whole Marilyn Monroe kind of conspiracy theorist sort of stuff. You know, did she kill herself? Was it accidental? Was she murdered? And it's, I think the kind of, you know, you'll never know. No one will ever know. Well, maybe someone does know, but, you know, it's unanswerable and yet very intriguing because, you know, you just want to know.
Yeah. It's like the one I was going to say that it was in the papers a couple of weeks ago. Is it Richard Warner, the American actor whose girlfriend just disappeared on the boat?
Yes.
And then she was found a few days later. He'd come back with the other actor whose name I can't remember.
Was it Natalie Wood?
Yeah, Natalie Wood.
Yes.
Yeah.
But now they're saying they've found new evidence that suggests she was murdered, and it's gosh, what evidence can you find so many years later? Yeah. That side of things fascinates me when it comes to cold cases. The fact that something from so many years ago could now provide evidence that will catch a killer, that really intrigues me. The fact that you could have a t-shirt of a victim with some DNA on it now that can be identified, you know, 50 years later.
Yeah.
And finally somebody's going to get closure on that. I think that's the best part of the whole sort of cold case thing at the minute. Yeah.
He's contradicted himself, hasn't he, on record? That's the thing, because so many people have interviewed him about it. He's given conflicting accounts of what happened.
I don't know
if that's the main thrust of the investigation, but that's definitely something that's been mentioned, you know, when it's come back up, that it doesn't, unfortunately, seem like it adds up.
You can't keep that sort of thing to yourself and consistent for that many years, can you? It's going to come out eventually if something untoward did happen.
In 1921, in Wisconsin, the body of a young boy was found floating in a pond. And he had been killed by blunt force trauma and was aged, or estimated to age, between 5 and 7. And his clothes were quite expensive. And he had blonde hair and brown eyes and one missing tooth. And because of the quality of his clothes, it was believed that he came from an affluent background. And he was nicknamed Little Lord Fauntleroy, which I can't say. I probably should have picked something I could say. And despite the police displaying his body and it being in the press and things like that, nobody ever came forwards to identify the boy. And eventually a local woman who was unrelated, as we know, raised money, because obviously you had to pay to be buried then, so that the kiddie could be buried. And there are repeated sightings of a heavily veiled woman who used to visit the grave and leave flowers. Mm. And it was always kind of believed that she knew who he really was, but nobody ever came forward.
Wow. Mm. Yeah, that's chilling.
That's a bit sad as well, isn't it?
I mean, there are various theories. I mean, one of which is that he was a kidnapped victim from another part of America, and that the kidnappers disposed of the body in Wisconsin, and that's why nobody recognised him. But I also kind of think that if that was... I guess it's the kind of the reverse of like a Madeleine McCann case where, you know, the child is missing, you know, and I'm not sure if nowadays if you had, I mean, there's been the torso in the Thames, but if you had a fully intact child, would it really be possible for nobody to identify them? Just seems, you know, with so much coverage, idea that somebody could miss that. You know, not see that. You know, think about the kind of Facebook campaigns that we started, etc. It just seems like it's something that perhaps wouldn't happen anymore. I'm sure it would. I'm looking at Rob.
There was a... I can't remember the circumstances, but it was the young African child who was found dismembered in a suitcase. Yeah. That would be, 10, 12 years ago? I'm guessing. And it took a considerable amount of time to find out what had happened to that child, because it wasn't a British national.
Living trafficked.
I don't think it was a trafficked child, but it was... No, I wouldn't like to confirm that. But if you're not a British national, if you've come here recently and you're not on any sort of database, you don't go to school, your family... maybe just move to this country, and then I can understand why people wouldn't recognise, people wouldn't know. If your community is one that is isolationist and doesn't sort of integrate with others, I can see why how some deceased bodies wouldn't be identified. But I think I agree with you. It's far, far harder these days with the social media.
Yeah,
it's huge.
Yeah,
but also, you know, everything on the internet. 20, 30 years ago, it just didn't exist. And that was everywhere.
You think back in the 1920s, what, being able to sort of write on Snapchat you a picture of him and, you know, around the country in 10 minutes, it's drawings, isn't it? It's somebody's drawings.
Yes, that's precisely what they did.
How are you going to identify and definitely say, from someone else's interpretation of a dead body, you're not going to say for definite, that's Jimmy from down the street, can you? It's so sad.
It is.
Really sad.
And less people, on a practical sense, can read.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, if you can't read the newspaper and you know that your son's missing, but you can't read the newspaper that's telling you that there's a little boy being found 10 miles away. Yeah. scary, but it's quite comforting that we live in a world now where the chances of that kind of thing happening are far less because of social media.
They think that's one of the reasons why the number of serial killers, at least in the States, I've seen stats on it, has dropped, because it's so much harder for people to disappear now than it was before. It's so much easier to kind of keep track of people.
Yeah.
So people would notice. So they might be killed in the first place, but you hopefully stand more chance that the killer would be caught before they then killed another person.
Yeah, with CCTV and all that kind of thing, and straight away you've got watching them getting away and things like that, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to take us to the Twitter questions now. So we've had a few questions submitted via Twitter. Firstly, Scooty413 asks, do you believe there's really such a thing as the perfect murder in this day and age, considering the progress in forensic expertise? I always wondered if the perfect murderer could ever be a forensic scientist.
Ooh.
Thoughts on that?
I love that question.
It's a nice twist, but I'm going to be really boring and say yes. It's still possible to commit the perfect murder. You just push somebody down the stairs and make sure that they die. Because there's nothing, if you say it was an accident, there's very little there's not going to be kind of imprints on them or anything like that. And if you live with that person, for example, your DNA is going to be all over them anyway, etc. And but you have to scale it back. But it's much more fascinating to think if a forensic scientist was kind of, I guess, what, planting things or destroying things.
There's a book.
Sorry, can I just take your name deliberately?
Yeah. My husband is still alive.
Make sure you don't have his handprints.
Do you know what might be an interesting thing though that might foil the pushing the perfect crime in that sense? With smart TVs and Echoes and Alexa now, they're a lot of the time they're recording more than we think they're recording.
Because they record the first 3 seconds of every word that's said, in case you're saying Alexa something.
Indeed.
Because there was a case in the States where that's precisely what happened, and they implicated the husband in the killing of his wife. Wow. And it is because she said Alexa recorded it, and they were able to say. Wow. But in that case, I think it was that they proved that he was in the house.
Right.
Whereas he said he wasn't in the house. I think she was in the hot tub. I might have made that bit up. But there's definitely been a case in the States where they've used Alexa to kind of solve a crime.
So when I'm swearing at my Hoover because it won't work, then Alexa's... I'm being recorded.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then presumably Amazon knows that you need a new Hoover.
Yes, it's offering me lots of Hoovers, right.
We've noticed you're angry with the Hoover. So here is a range of £300.
Shocking if they did that.
Couldn't you argue that every unsolved murder is potentially a perfect murder?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. If you've got away with it, then it's... Yeah. Yeah,
I think the two I'm thinking about, they're pretty perfect, but they were years ago.
Mm.
And nobody's been any closer to discovering who the perpetrator was.
That's
good.
So I will move us on to the next question,
yeah.
If that's all right. So now I've got to try and say this right. @Clur2 asks, if you were given the power to remove one law from the statute books and or create a new one, what would it be and why?
Does it have to be crime related or can it be wine related?
It doesn't say it has to be crime, so I think wine is fine. But what's your wine related law, Emma?
It's a must.
You have to have it on a daily basis.
Everybody has to
have it.
Medicinal purposes.
Yes.
Right.
Universal wine care.
Yes. That's the one.
What could go wrong?
The NWS. Yeah. A National Wine Service.
I'm a serious crime related now. I don't know. It's a hard question, that, I think.
When I researched for Watch Me, which is the second book in the Social Media Murder series, there's a revenge porn plotline that runs through it, and I spoke to the revenge porn helpline during that process, and I discovered that it is not illegal to Photoshop somebody's face onto a hardcore porn image and distribute it. So, for example, there have been cases where people have Photoshopped people's faces very convincingly onto hardcore images and then distributed it to their work colleagues, their community, their religious leader. Those people have then been ostracized and cast out because people don't understand that it's not real, or they aren't, you know, perhaps interested in that aspect. And unfortunately, sometimes that has resulted in to the very extreme, people have taken their own lives because they've lost their families, they've lost their jobs, they've lost everything. And I find it really shocking that that particular aspect, I mean, you can get somebody under harassment for that, but I think that manipulation of images and use of images in that particular way should be made to deliberately try and hurt people in that way should be made illegal.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I can't believe that's not illegal.
I know, it's quite shocking.
That's really,
it's
shocking. Really shocking, yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty full on, is that, isn't it? That's a really crappy crime.
Mm. And it's worth pointing out as well that it's not always, because people might automatically assume that it's women that happened to, but it's not always. Sometimes it's guys onto kind of gay porn, and again, the impact as well, it can be, it's devastating.
Yeah.
I think that's really, really topical, especially now with the machine learning algorithms that have been able to do these kind of videos as well, and you know, moving so photographic images can be incredibly convincing and look very realistic. When you start putting on videos and these algorithms are able to actually kind of essentially graft someone's face if you give them enough material, photographic material to do it, and that's exactly what's happening. I mean, it's been done mostly with celebrities so far, but if you think about all of the pictures we all put up on social media, it's not inconceivable that if someone was able to access your Facebook profile, they could put in that information and they could do that. And I mean, picture might say 1,000 words, but a video, it's.
I mean, I'm fairly cynical, and if I saw a video, I would probably assume it was the real deal.
Exactly right.
Yeah,
that's quite shocking. That is genuinely really shocking.
Mm. And what's interesting, I think, as well with that is that there's been because it's so recent, I don't think there's even been a kind of sustained debate, as far as I know, about the legality of it, other than perhaps an extension of what you were talking about.
But revenge porn took time to catch up with what was actually happening in real life. I mean, it was a good few years after they'd been campaigning before. Revenge porn was only illegal in 2012, I think.
Yeah.
It became, before that, it wasn't illegal, but obviously it was a thing before that, and with social media, it's become much more of a thing.
Yeah,
you know, you're no longer kind of printing images and pushing it through people's doors. You're, delivering it to tens of thousands of people at a click of a button.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see the response, like beyond the legal, the kind of moral and sort of ethical response from sites like Reddit, who have banned, the kind of the sharing of those images. Who've said we're just not going to have this on here. Even, sites who are typically quite open and to free expression, and people, make it, because a lot of the argument was around, we're playing with the technology, and they were doing all sorts of random stuff as well, like putting Nicolas Cage's face on movie characters and things like that, which, is quite amusing and frivolous, but, it's the darker side and the implications of it, but they kind of banned those subreddits, which I thought was quite an interesting community response from a community who get generally quite a bad rap for
it's kind of opposite as historically what 4chan have done, though, isn't it? Because 4chan have very much been at the forefront of kind of saying that the internet privacy is key, and that whatever you do is not you can't be judged for it in that sense. But it's interesting. I think if we don't change the law, we definitely need to kind of incorporate this into our kind of education and teaching of people as they come up, and not just children but adults as well, so that people understand what they're doing. the technology develops so fast nowadays. You know, Facebook is only 10 years old last year, and you know, think about how that impact that's had. I mean, it's 44 million hits in the UK every day on Facebook. Yeah. I mean, it's had huge, kind of caused huge social change. And with great power comes great responsibility. it's developing, the technology is developing faster than we can develop kind of social etiquette and laws to keep up with it. So it's, you know, we're having to kind of like feel our way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In that sense. And, you know, some of this stuff, well, a lot of this stuff needs to be addressed.
Yeah. I had something completely different. And it's not so much to do with the law, it's to do with sentencing.
Mm.
This country, sorry. Go to the States. Let's look at John Wallboys, the rapist, who was maybe released quite shortly. If that was to occur in the States, every single one of those offences, he would serve X amount of years for one offence.
Yeah.
And then when that sentence is over, he'd start the sentence for the next offence.
Yeah.
And then the next offence. They're consecutive sentences. So he'll spend, let's say, 10 years in prison for one rape. He'll serve that 10 years, and then he'll start another 10 year sentence for the next one.
Mm.
And then another 10. He will never, ever, if that happened in the States, he will never, ever be released. In this country, we do have a weak judicial system where a person can be found guilty of 20, 30, 40 rapes. And that sentence would all be served concurrently at the same time. I've never, ever been able to understand how that is how that is justice for the victims.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Because it seems as if one person gets justice and all the others just don't seem to matter.
Yeah.
I'm going to put forward a controversial response that I agree entirely. I think the issue is that is a crime that is predominantly committed against women, and predominantly, like you see again and again, that the judicial system doesn't always serve women to the best of its ability, especially in cases with rape. So I entirely agree. I think that it should be addressed. I just wanted to put that little tiny bit of feminism in there as a footnote. I would also like to say that though I made the point about guys being, you know, the victims of revenge porn, they are generally around about kind of the 25% of the victims that we're aware of revenge porn, 75% are women. Again, instances of kind of trolling, and when that took time for trolling to be, inverted commas, taken seriously and become like a legal issue in that sense, again, is something that's predominantly perpetrated against women. And I think that that's a real weakness throughout our judicial system. You know, we think of ourselves as living in an egalitarian society. We think of ourselves as being very forward thinking, and we are compared to a lot of other countries and a lot of other places, and I accept that. But I think that we have societal, historical instances where women are or were seen as the lesser of the two sexes, and I think that we're still having to sift through elements of that in terms of kind of the judicial system and what needs to be addressed on that front.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to have anybody disagree with me. We're all nodding.
Okay, I'm going to move us on. Now, this question, I think, is particularly for Rob, but if anyone else has expertise in this area, please share. So, at Orlanlis asks, if a murder happens overseas and the suspect is a resident in the UK, what involvement do the UK police have?
Well, I would stand to be corrected on this, but most of that comes down to, it's still my understanding, consular conventions between other nations and the UK. So, for example, if a murder was committed in, let's say, Germany, and the suspect lives in this country, then the German authorities would present the information, the evidential information they have, to the CPS in this country, and if it met the burden of proof, then that European arrest warrant would be executed, and the suspect would be arrested and deported. You can get international arrest warrants then for countries outside Europe if they've got those consular conventions with the UK. And I'm sure I'm right in saying it's a consular convention, but I do stand to be corrected if I'm wrong on that. But of course, you've got other countries then who would be outside of that, and it's a bit of a handbag fight then between the countries as to can we have that offender or not? But I think the important thing to mention is if that, like I said, the person in Germany, they can't go on a fishing expedition and just deport somebody just on the chance it might be, it will have to be a case put together with sufficient evidence to justify the arrest of that individual.
What if the suspect is already in Germany and they've caught him and is in a German prison?
For an offence in Germany?
For an offence in Germany, I think, yeah. And would the British police be involved in that investigation, or is it all in Germany? So if the British resident is in Germany, has committed the crime, then he's staying there, he's going on trial there. And
committed offence in Germany, then he's subject to German law. Yeah. Obviously, there may well be some liaison with our authorities out in Germany, but
I think that's my interpretation of the question, is that if it was...
If he's a British national, but he's in Germany, committed offence in Germany, then he's subject to German law.
Mm. Right.
Do you think... this is an unfair question, because I'm not sure how you would necessarily know the answer to this, but do you think that if somebody was arrested for a crime in a country that, say, had the death penalty for something that we don't have the death penalty here, so I'm thinking more drugs rather than murder, do you think that we would fight extradition in that sense, or do you think it would still be, so if the person was back here?
So a foreign country with a death penalty wants to, my belief is Britain would not extradite the person if that person could be subject to the death penalty. Many years ago, when I was a sergeant, we had two Algerian brothers in the city I worked in at the time. Both paedophiles, both had previous convictions for molesting young boys. They were wanted back in Algeria, but this country wouldn't extradite them back to Algeria because they would likely face the death penalty. And it would have been against their human rights to do that. So they allowed them to stay in this country where they continue to molest young boys.
So they weren't, like a quid pro quo. They weren't prosecuted here and for the crimes they committed abroad and then served time here, for example, rather than...
They were imprisoned in this country.
They were.
But they were never deported to Algeria.
Right. Because they'd have faced the death penalty.
Yes.
Against the human rights in this country.
It's very complex.
The human rights is a much bigger situation, and I think it's down to interpretation that the way that the judiciary in this country uses that bit of legislation. And I think it's more down to interpretation than issues with the legislation. Mm. It could be interpreted in a completely different way.
Good question.
Good answer. On the spot. So finally, I wondered whether you have a favourite crime fiction book of all time. Now, I was sort of thinking about this myself and thinking, which book do I say? Because I have so many. So I'm going to go with, because it's sort of crime rather than thriller in the question, I'm going to go with The Good Girl by Mary Kubeka, which I was her debut novel, and I reread it and it kind of still stays with me today, about a young woman who is abducted, but it has some great twists in it. That's all I'm going to say about that. So I'm open to you. Who has their favourite crime book?
Mine was a really hard question, and I feel really bad for asking all the authors this question all the time now that I've been asked it myself, but I'm going to have to say mine was probably Enid Blyton's The Secret of Spiggy Holes, which is the first one I remember reading.
Oh, wow.
So it's the one that probably got me hooked into crime. Four kids watching some dubious goings-on at a run-down house on the hill. And I can see my old book of it, and I just wish I had it. But I'd read it so many times it fell to pieces years ago, but I'd love that book back. There's so many great ones, modern ones, but definitely that was the first one I read, and that's stuck with me forever. So
brilliant.
Cheers, Enid.
I'm going to be very flighty because I've been asked this question before and I always give a different answer each time.
I totally do that.
It's so hard because it's really hard. I'm better at like kind of sort of qualifying like my top five or my top ten, yes, and they sort of move around as to which is in number one position. But today, my favourite crime book of all time is Dorothy L. Sayers Gaudy Knight, which I love, which is a little bit of a cheat for anybody who's read it because actually it's probably the least crimey of her Lord Peter Wimsey series that she wrote, but by Gaudy Knight, I've become so heavily invested in Harriet Vane and Lord Peter Wimsey as characters and their relationship together, that it completely won me over. But if you are going to go back and read that, start from Strong Poison, which is where Harriet Vane first appears, which I have to say, a big shout out to Ruth Ware for telling me that. She was like, oh, if you're going to read Dorothy L. Sayers, start at Strong Poison. And she was so right. And then work your way through.
Rob, Chris, favourite crime book?
Favourite, I'll put in my favourite, but the one that sticks in my mind is, I read it years ago, was In Cold Blood by Truman Capote. Bizarre, I came to read it. I read it because of Breakfast at Tiffany's, which came from my infatuation with Audrey Hepburn. I was a teenager.
Cheers, Audrey.
It sort of, well, psychologists make up my sort of thought process then. But
Breakfast will tell you. Yeah. We'll let you know. The book is much darker than the film.
Exactly, much darker than the film. Then I read the book, and the book is completely different than the film. Mm. And then I looked for other books by the author, and then came across Coda, which was, but it's the way it's written. What interests me was the fact it was a novelist writing a true crime.
Yeah.
And then the background of both the offenders and the sort of relationship between them, which was quite interesting. So I suppose it reads a bit dated now, but it's the sort of book that sticks in my mind.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Chris, what about you?
I think mine's like maybe a little bit of an odd one for a crime one, but I always loved like Stephen King books growing up as well. So I love Misery. I just thought it was a bit of a departure from his. And I love the kind of context behind it and what was going on in his kind of career at that point in his life. And I just think it's a fantastic book. Mm-hmm. And it's probably my favourite of his now. And actually, I love the movie adaptation as well. And yeah, it's just a great, great book.
Yeah. Obviously, what we all wanted to say was My Little Lie. as our all-time favourite.
Yeah.
But we thought that, you know,
absolutely. I think it's fair and not.
That's second.
Great crime books out there, but My Little Lie.
Well, thank you. A huge thank you to all of my guests on the podcast. Say to Chris, to Emma, to Rob, and to Angela. And thank you very much for listening and joining us on the My Little Eye podcast series. My Little Eye, the book, is now out in paperback on the 5th of April, and it's available to download as an ebook and also in audio. So before we go, here's one final clip from the audiobook.
At 5 o'clock, he posts the reminder in case files, The Lover. Deathstalker. Remember, there's a press briefing tonight at 6 p.m. at Robert Chainsaw Jameson. You're our eyes on this. Robert Chainsaw Jameson. I've managed to get a press pass via my friend. I'll take notes and report back. I have to find a way to stay in the group. The memory of my 11th birthday with father still lingers in my mind. Make tough choices or you won't survive. Well, his choices were bad. And I need to do more than just survive. I want to beat the police. I have to show there's another way to get justice. I stare out of the window, watching people scuttling along the street below. It's dusk. In a few minutes, the sun will be gone. It's harder to observe in the gloom, and that makes it easier to go to places you shouldn't. It gives me an idea to get inside the crime scene. The briefing at 6 is my opportunity. The detectives will be with the press. If I'm lucky, the uniforms will be gone too. It's the perfect time to make a return visit. I grab my boots and zip them up over my leggings, pull on my coat, and put my phone and purse into the pockets. I plait my hair into a loose braid and pin it up on the top of my head, then pull on a black beanie. I try to ignore the fluttering in my chest. I'm ready. I'm determined to do this. I'm terrified.